listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Yesterday, the Wisconsin Supreme Court adopted Governor Tony Evers' plans for new congressional and legislative district maps that will last a decade. Justice Brian Hagedorn joined the court's liberal members in the 4-3 ruling. While the district boundaries from Evers' map will likely maintain a Republican advantage in the legislature, it could narrow the GOP's majority in the Assembly and Senate. We're looking at what Evers' maps mean for Democrats and Republicans in the state and compare them to the other maps that didn't make the cut. John D. Johnson is a research fellow at the Marquette Law School's Lubar Center for Public Policy Research and Civic Education. John analyzed all the redistricting plans submitted to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. I talked to him earlier today. Let's set up yesterday's decision with a previous state Supreme Court decision that said what they were looking for in a new map, the least changes idea. Not, as I understand, a part of the Constitution on this. What did that decision mean?
That decision meant that if you take a few steps back, Republicans were going to get a very good map for themselves, because it meant that whatever new map was chosen would have to minimize changes from the 2011 gerrymander drawn by Republicans when they had unified control of the state government.
Now we have this decision yesterday. We had a bunch of different maps on offer. The legislature's one from Governor Evers, a revised one with that least change policy in mind, and a few others. They went with Governor Evers' proposal. What does that mean in terms of how big a change there is and what happens with that gerrymander?
Well, I believe they chose Governor Evers' proposal because it moves the fewest people from their old district to a new district. The concept of least change is not clearly defined. Many observers thought it was strange that the justices chose that in their earlier decision that you referenced, but that's the decision they made. And what can least change mean if not moving the fewest residents between districts? And Governor Evers' map is the one that moved the fewest people. So those are the maps that were chosen. So, given that, that means that they're not a whole lot different than what exists in the state right now, but they are better for Democrats than the map that had been proposed by the Wisconsin legislature. To put some specific numbers on that, in a statewide tie, I reckon Democrats right now would likely win 38 seats under the new maps drawn by Governor Evers, which the Supreme Court has just accepted. If they had chosen the legislature's plan, that would be 36 seats for Democrats. To put some perspective on that, Democrats currently have 38 seats, and under the final map drawn by the People's Map Commission, which did not use a least change strategy, Democrats could expect to win 44 seats in a statewide tie. But another way that these are different is how many competitive seats they draw. So we can talk about that, too.
Well, I want to get that the bottom half of that fraction there. That's 38 seats plus or minus out of, I believe, 99 assembly seats. You're saying in a statewide election where the votes come in exactly tied for the assembly, Democrats still come in with a pretty substantial loss when it comes to the number of seats they get.
That's right. Yeah.
Why is that? Even if this is a map endorsed here by Governor Evers, again, with that least change policy in mind.
Yeah, well, the Democrats are at a disadvantage across the state because they are more concentrated in cities. So when you draw districts that are compact and contiguous, which is what our sort of legal standards for drawing districts are, you're going to end up having a handful of extremely blue Democratic seats in places like Madison and Milwaukee, and there won't be similarly extremely red seats just because there aren't really places in Wisconsin that are as deeply Republican as there are places that are very deeply Democratic. Now, that said, that only explains a small part or maybe half of the Republicans' advantage in the state assembly. So that People's Map Commission map, which was drawn by the commission put together by Governor Evers, would have come up with 44 seats for Democrats in a statewide tie. And it was drawn just starting from scratch, looking at the state and drawing compact and contiguous maps. So still a disadvantage to Democrats, but much less of a disadvantage than currently exists. So the plan proposed by Evers that was accepted yesterday by the Supreme Court is worse for Democrats than a sort of randomly drawn map would be, because it was constrained by trying to closely match the map drawn in 2011 by the Republicans who controlled the state government at that point.
Talking to John Johnson from the Marquette Law School's Lubar Center for Public Policy Research and Civic Education, looking at the state Supreme Court's decision on Wisconsin's new voting maps. John, we've talked about the assembly seats, people watching for the congressional seats here in Wisconsin. What do we know about how these maps would affect how those shake out?
Compared to the map proposed by the state legislature, the maps that Evers submitted and that were accepted keep the third district in southwestern Wisconsin pretty competitive. The Republican plan would have tipped it more towards the Republicans, so that will remain a competitive seat. And the new plan also makes the first district in southeastern Wisconsin several points more competitive. So really, in Wisconsin, we have a situation now where there are going to be two safe Republican seats, two safe Democratic seats, and two seats which are competitive and probably lean slightly Republican. But in a good year for Democrats, they could hope to win both of those.
Another way to measure, going back to the state legislature now, another way to measure the lean here, we've been talking about, okay, if the votes came out tied, what would the split be? The votes come out tied, Republicans in any of these maps come out ahead. What would it take for Democrats to capture a majority? What would the threshold of statewide vote have to get to put Democrats ahead in, say, the assembly?
So to have a good chance at winning 50 seats in the assembly, which, as you say, would be a bare majority, Democrats would need to win about 53.7% of the vote under the Evers plan. Under the map proposed by the legislature, they would have needed to win 56.2% of the vote. Under the existing maps, they would need to win about 54.3% of the vote. So you can see this is a modest improvement for Democrats from the existing map, and it's considerably better than the map that the Republicans themselves proposed during this cycle. It is not as good for Democrats as the map that was submitted by the People's Map Commission, which ignored the least change criteria. Under that plan, Democrats could have hoped to win a majority of the assembly with just a 51.3% statewide victory.
Anything else strike you as interesting or noteworthy about the maps as they stand now after this approval by the state Supreme Court?
One thing I've been sort of amused by is the fate of Stevens Point, which I'm sure it's been frustrating for the people in Stevens Point to feel like a political football being kicked around through both this redistricting cycle and the previous one. But as some of your listeners will know, Stevens Point is part of this odd panhandle coming off of the third congressional district. It's contiguous, but it's definitely not compact. And it was drawn that way in 2011 because the Republican mapmakers wanted to put that Democratic stronghold of Stevens Point into the third congressional district, which at that time they saw as a safe Democratic seat that they weren't going to try to pick off. Now, as voting patterns have changed, the third seems like a good pickup opportunity for Republicans. And so they wanted to hasten that process along by making the third district more compact and removing Stevens Point from it. So that was the plan that they submitted to the Supreme Court. And now they submitted their plan before the Supreme Court ruled that they wanted least change to be the criteria. Evers saw that ruling and submitted his own least change map, in which he perfectly preserved the old strange panhandle of Stevens Point in the third district, which was drawn to benefit Republicans in 2011, but now in 2022 actually benefits Democrats. So there are ways in which the least change plan, although generally favorable to Republicans, in some instances did actually help Democrats.
John, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again.
Thank you.
John D. Johnson is a research fellow at the Marquette Law School's Lubar Center for Public Policy Research and Civic Education. In January, he published an analysis of all the redistricting plans that were submitted to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. He joined us for a look at what the new district maps would mean for Democrats and Republicans in Wisconsin. For more on this process, follow the news at WPR.org and check out the recent WPR Reports podcast, Mapped Out. Coming up, the January 6th Congressional Committee says President Trump and his associates may have committed criminal acts in their efforts to overturn the 2020 presidential election. A legal expert joins the show for a look at the accusations and what they mean. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. This week, we got one of the biggest updates we've seen in the ongoing work of the House of Representatives Select Committee that's investigating the insurrection of the nation's capital on January 6th, 2021, and the events leading up to it. In a court filing, the committee's legal team claimed they've gathered evidence that Trump and others he was working with to overturn the 2020 election may have broken several laws. That comes from numerous depositions from top aides to former President Trump and former Vice President Mike Pence. David Schultz is Distinguished University Professor of Political Science and Legal Studies. He teaches political science at Hamline University and is a professor of law at the University of Minnesota. David, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me again.
There's a lot going into this, David. Can you give us the basics? What does this suggestion of possible criminal activity, where did this come from?
Okay, so this is the January 6th Commission that's doing our January 6th committee, which is reviewing the events of that day. They've gathered an incredible amount of information, as you indicated in your introduction here. And in a filing that was released a couple days ago, which is about 100 pages long, they detail all the factual allegations regarding how Trump worked with his staff, and staff tried to convince him that first there was no election fraud, but he nonetheless persisted in what he was doing. And it talks about how he and several of people associated with him, including John Eastman, as a private attorney, basically conspired to try to overthrow the 2020 election. And so what we found in the document that was released the other day was an effort to try to get what's called a breaking of the attorney-client confidentiality between Trump and his attorney, John Eastman. And in there, what was indicated are three possible criminal charges that could be brought against Donald Trump, as well as some of his associates. And if I can briefly mention them here, one is that the argument is that the president and maybe others obstructed or tried to obstruct an official government proceeding of the United States. That is the counting of the electoral votes. Second, there's an argument that in fact, the president and his campaign engaged in a criminal conspiracy to defraud the United States by trying to trick people or fool people into thinking there was widespread voter fraud. And then the last is that there may have been under state law in the District of Columbia, there might have been a violation of what's called common law fraud, deception. But put this together, what they're saying at this point is that because we believe we have enough evidence at this point to believe that the president and his associates may have been breaking the law, that is a basis for us to want to now what? Force John Eastman, his attorney, to divulge private communications between him and Donald Trump for the purposes of us investigating criminal activity. This is pretty significant.
This is an effort, as you said, to get access to these emails, overcome the attorney-client privilege claim here. This is a congressional committee, though, not a prosecutorial agency or body. What would it take to get from there, these claims from a congressional committee, to somebody actually filing charges under those claims?
Well, what could happen at this point is once they complete their report, they could then refer this over to the Justice Department, and the Justice Department could, based upon this report, opt to indict on, let's say, at least the federal charges. Obviously, it has limited authority over what the District of Columbia does. But that would be the process at this point in terms of preparing a report that would then be used as the basis, perhaps, for the Justice Department to indict the president or any of his ex-president or any of his associates.
We don't have a lot of precedent for ex-presidents being charged with crimes, right? It's a pretty tall order.
It is a very tall order at this point. And the closest we've ever gotten is Richard Nixon. And of course, this was all about what? Crimes that Nixon allegedly committed while he was president of the United States. Back in the 70s, the argument was that a sitting president could not be indicted. which is why for some people who might have remembered the phrase Nixon and as an unindicted co-conspirator, it wasn't clear that a sitting president could be indicted. But there's nobody that I know of, any respectable legal authority that would say that an ex-president cannot be indicted for crimes, even for crimes committed while he was president of the United States. So if this were to happen, this would be an unprecedented move in American legal history.
Right. We didn't get that question addressed, right? Because President Ford, who succeeded former President Nixon, pardoned him. And that prevented these questions from going into the courts. Do you think they might have without that pardon?
I think at that point, had Nixon no longer been president and had it moved forward in terms of an investigation and indictment, it's more than likely that he probably would have been indicted. And you're absolutely correct that Gerald Ford decided to issue a presidential pardon to prevent that from going forward. Again, if you look at Justice Department documents from back in the 1970s, there seemed to be a consensus that yes, an ex-president, a person who's no longer a president or not president, could be indicted. The whole focus then was on a sitting president. And that's why Ford pardoned him, because Nixon at that point no longer enjoyed any type of presumption of perhaps not being able to be indicted.
Talking to David Schultz from Hamline University and University of Minnesota, looking at the January 6th commission, some news out there in a court filing saying potential to believe that criminal activity committed by President Trump and some of his closest advisors in their efforts to overturn the 2020 presidential election result. David, in this, as you say, 100-page filing, there were some emails, I think new ones that we hadn't seen before, related to John Eastman on January 6th, back and forths with the staff of Vice President Pence. Eastman trying to persuade the staff, to persuade Pence to put off the counting of electoral votes, even saying at one point, acknowledging this would be at least a minor violation of relevant law. Did you see anything shocking in this?
I did see that. I mean, first off, and I think that this report or this memorandum made it clear, is that there is no basis in the law whatsoever for arguing that the Vice President of the United States or that Congress really has the authority to set aside electoral votes. The Constitution and the 12th Amendment are very clear on this. And part of what the court is arguing here is to say that there was no good faith argument that Eastman could make to the president to say, you know, we think you have some authority to order Pence or get Pence to do this. And so Eastman is basically telling Pence to do something that clearly, and I would say clearly, any lawyer worth his or her salt would know that this was not possible under the Constitution. But yet, needless to say, he pushes on. And what I think the purpose of this request for privileged information is to find out what else Eastman did. What else was he advising the president? And so this is what makes it so significant here, is that we effectively have somebody who's providing advice to the president, if everything in here is true and accurate, that was basically telling the president, guess what, violate federal law and urge your vice president to violate federal law and the U.S. Constitution.
There's been a lot of attention to testimony to the committee that suggests that people were telling, as you mentioned, telling then President Trump that there hadn't been significant fraud. Also out in a new book, former Attorney General William Barr says basically the last thing he did as Attorney General was telling President Trump, no, there wasn't significant widespread fraud. You lost the election. Why is it important for people to make that case? Is that related to that potential fraud?
Well, I think what's important at this point is that, first, if people have broken the law, they should be held accountable. But two, and I think without being too dramatic here, this is about American democracy, that even if at the end of the day, Trump or his associates aren't indicted, it's a statement about saying that there are certain things you can't do in a democracy, in a country like the United States, and that includes what? Basically trying to overturn democratically elected elections. And you can't go around what lying about the fact that there's voter fraud and then use those lies as a basis for trying to challenge election results. I think that's the broader point that comes out of this, is that sometimes principle matters. And I think this is partly what's going on here.
I won't ask you to predict the future, David. How likely do you think it is, though, that somebody, say an attorney general or someone within the Justice Department, would pick up this information from the congressional committee and run with it and indict the president's advisors, maybe the former president himself?
I think the pressure is going to be tremendous on at least going after the president's advisors. The question becomes, to what extent going after Donald Trump, is that something that the Justice Department wants to take on in terms of it being potentially an incredibly divisive issue? And maybe that's why Gerald Ford back 50 years ago pardoned Richard Nixon, to say Nixon probably did something wrong, but we'd be better off, what, basically saying he did something wrong, pardon him, and let history be the judge. And that could very well be what would happen too.
And David, in our last minute or so, apart from these possible indictments, do you see any other safeguards, things that need to be changed to prevent a current or future president from losing an election but going to this long effort to overturn that outcome?
Well, first off, they're talking about revising the Electoral Count Act in terms of what Congress's role is. I think part of that is necessary in terms of just simply making clear what the law can do. But remember, presidential elections and Senate and U.S. House elections are done on a state-by-state basis. And I think what needs to be done is to insulate the election process, the election administration, even more from political influence. And what's dangerously going on right now is just the opposite, politicizing it. We probably need to insulate it more so that this doesn't happen in the future.
David, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you to the audience.
That's David Schultz, Distinguished University Professor of Political Science and Legal Studies at Hamline University, Professor of Law at the University of Minnesota. He joined us today for a look at a new court filing from the House Committee investigating the January 6th insurrection that lays out evidence for a possible criminal case against former President Donald Trump and some of his associates. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, we'll get the latest on the Russian invasion of Ukraine, including the latest developments over the weekend, plus a look at the international response to the invasion. And rental costs are up around the country. Wisconsin is no exception. We'll find out what's driving the high cost of rental housing, what it means for low and middle income renters. That and more coming up Monday here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, we learn more about the Pakistani-American experience from the author of a new memoir on his life in American culture, the challenges and the hope he's found along the way. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll talk with chef and public TV host Patty Heenich on this week's edition of Food Friday. She'll share recipes and advice to help us make Mexican cuisine in our own kitchens. First, many Muslim Americans experience racism and Islamophobia, especially in the post-9/11 United States. It can be tough to grapple with a sense of identity and belonging in a country that isn't always welcoming. Our next guest shares his story of the challenges and absurdities, the positive moments, and the funny moments, too. Wajahat Ali was born and grew up in California, the child of Pakistani-American immigrant parents. He tries to use humor to cope with discrimination and to tell the story of his experience finding himself in the United States. And he says alongside the challenges, he feels a lot of hope. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you or your family had experiences with Islamophobia or racism? What was it like? How do you see Muslim Americans treated in your neck of the woods? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. Wajahat Ali is a playwright, a columnist for The Daily Beast, co-host of the Democracy-ish podcast, and author of the new book, Go Back to Where You Came From, and other helpful recommendations on becoming American. Wajahat, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
You've got no shortage of stories to tell in your life story, from awkward childhood moments to near-death experiences and more. What led you to want to put it all down in memoir-ish form?
Yeah, memoirish. I like that. It's you know, the story, Go Back to Where You Came From, is about loving a country that doesn't always love you back. And I consider it an elegy for the rest of us who oftentimes are seen as the co-protagonists, sidekicks, villains, or we're completely erased from the story and just treated as footnotes. And I thought in this moment in time, there might be an opening, Rob, where fellow Americans might realize, huh, these people of color, these immigrants, these marginalized folks, they're not lying about this thing called white supremacy and racism. They might be onto something. And huh, all their warnings about our democracy being under attack and the fact that we might not have a multiracial democracy, there might be something here to it. So I thought this was a critical time where I could tell this story, my story, but connect it to the story of America right now, undergoing many atrocities and horrors as we are simultaneously doing this push and pull between nativist trends that have existed and the trend to push and expand this country to accommodate all of our children as its potential co-protagonists. So I thought the time was now.
Your parents laid out three career options for you, as I understand it. Doctor, engineer, or successful businessman. Not just businessman, successful businessman. How did you develop your superpower as a writer and storyteller?
Well, yeah, the fourth option is failure. So you forgot failure.
I forgot failure. Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah.
That's what I call the immigrant checklist of success. It's not just South Asian parents, but it's basically, hey, we came to this country. We left behind everything. We didn't leave behind everything for you to become an English major. And, you know, we want stability and security for you. And we want the dreams that you can't have. So you have to be a doctor or an engineer or a dubious businessman or a businesswoman who somehow makes a lot of money and he marries well and has 2.1 kids and gets a nice house and gets either a Toyota Acura or a BMW. And, you know, my parents being Pakistani immigrant parents, very traditional. We always joke that they brought the boat inside the home. Like, they didn't burn the boat. They brought the boat inside the home. First of all, they named me Wajahat, obviously to blend. They didn't teach me English growing up because who needs English in the Bay Area, California, right? Eh. And they said, eh, you'll learn. But they were very supportive of my artistic talents. So I wrote a story at the age of 10. I mentioned this in the book. And a one-page short story became a 10-page short story. And being this shy, awkward, brown, sweaty kid who wore husky pants, who used to get bullied by his classmates, my teacher said, get up and read this story. And I'm like, please don't make me do it. She goes, get up and do it. And for the first time ever, they were rapt with attention. They didn't mock me. They laughed at all the right parts and they applauded. And that's when I kind of discovered I might have a superhero talent. I might be able to tell a story. And I took that story home to my father, who was drinking chai. He says, beta, which means son, you might have a talent here. You might think about becoming a writer. And my mom ran from the kitchen and said, first become a doctor, which is just insurance, right? My mom was like, just have insurance. But I was very lucky, Rob, that my parents were very untraditional in that they always supported and nurtured the talent. And many children of immigrants don't have that support or that encouragement, and which is why they become doctors and engineers, but secretly very unhappy.
A running theme through the book is, you know, you have a lot of identities, awkward kid, writer, later father. I could go on with that list for a long time. When seen from the outside, especially I think after September 11th, other people, mainly white people, looked at you and saw what?
Osama, Saddam, ISIS, Al-Qaeda, suspect, other, terrorist, potential terrorist, helper of terrorists, potential radical terrorist who might not be a terrorist. Oh, look, a smiling terrorist. It's very interesting that all of us have complex identities, but oftentimes people are of color are the only ones who are hyphenated or have the asterisks, right? And in 9/11, as I mentioned in the book, for many of us, especially those immigrants, children of immigrants, people of color who grew up as the model minority stereotype, a stereotype I hope to demolish in the book, you know, we thought we were American, born and raised in this country, right? Yeah, sure, we don't see ourselves on the billboards or on the cover of the magazines, but we are American. We identify. But overnight, after 9/11, all of a sudden, we became us and them. You know, a terrorist or a suspect. And overnight, from that moment on, me, Wajahat Ali, a Muslim brown kid from California, had to represent and defend 1,400 years of Islamic civilization and 1.8 billion Muslims. And no matter what I did, as Toni Morrison said, that's the exhaustion of racism. It's never enough. You always have to prove your worth, and it's never enough because this nameless judge, jury, and executioner always holds your loyalty, moderation, and patriotism as suspect.
We're talking to Wajahat Ali, author of the new book, Go Back to Where You Came From and Other Helpful Recommendations on Becoming American. You can join in with your questions if you'd like at 800-642-1234. If you've experienced some of what Wajahat was just talking about, love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. The title, Go Back to Where You Came From, you write right off the bat, this is something you've heard, been emailed, you're active on social media, you've certainly encountered in there. I don't, like, what do you do with that when somebody, especially in person, when somebody says that to you? I don't know what I would do.
Yeah, you know what's so interesting is the title of the book is like a gut punch, right? And the book begins with emails that I receive every day. And I just copy paste the emails. And the first email is, go back to where you came from. I get it almost every day in some aspect, some form. And it's interesting is that for me, I'm so used to it and people of color are so used to it. But there are many readers in the past month, such as yourself, like, oh my God, this happens to you every day? Wow. How would I respond? And it just shows you how it is for the rest of us who, even though we're born and raised in this country, are told to go back. So it's how you respond. And so how I respond in the book is like Bugs Bunny. You know, Bugs Bunny is chased by Elmer Fudd and Yosemite Sam, but he uses their own traps against them and sometimes kisses them on the cheek. And at the end, he gets the last laugh, the last word, and he gets the carrot. And so I respond by saying, would you like me to go back to the Bay Area? I'd love to if you could subsidize the rent. Or, oh, are we all going back to the womb? Okay, Freud. Or do you want me to go back to pre-partition India? Because my parents, even my mother wasn't born in India. She was born in Pakistan. And that type of response with some humor is a response, but also kind of dismantles the stupidity and the bigotry of that comment, right? Where apparently the rest of us are here as conditional citizens, and our citizenship and our home loan application and our mortgage can be revoked at any second based upon our ethnicity. And the real American, Rob, apparently the one who was from here, is the white American who, by the way, wasn't from here. It actually belonged to the indigenous Americans, the Native Americans. So it's an ugly sentiment that has been told even to white Americans who weren't once considered white. And if you know your history, I'm talking about Italians, the Irish Catholic, Eastern European Jews, and the Germans. We were all told at one point to go back to where we came from.
Right. But I wonder how you think that, if that's going to change over generations. Like, my family goes back to Poland and Ireland, some other places. You wouldn't know that unless I told you, or you did my family, my genealogy or whatever. I just read as white now. You are, you know, second generation, your kids third generation. Do you worry that because of the skin color difference, that's never going to go away?
Yeah, that's a question I address in the book. You know, that's the test of America. Whether or not America will succeed as a multiracial democracy will be whether or not people like me are considered American or my children are considered American. I'll give you an example. Who's been here since the founding? Black folks. Are they still considered American? Nope, still hyphenated. Latinos? Nope, still hyphenated. Mexicans, indigenous Americans, right? With you and your family, you mentioned Polish and Irish, double whammy, both hated back in the day, but you were able to be absorbed into what I call in the book whiteness. And I'm not talking about white people. With whiteness, it's this paradigm, this structure, this ideology that says those who are considered white or labeled white, which is a social construct, are elevated above all others and are seen as the true inheritors of this country called America, right? Where they have the manifest destiny to come birth this country from savagery and bring forth civilizations. But you are able to be absorbed into whiteness because you look quote unquote white. Again, a social construct, even though you weren't considered white like 100 years ago. Irish were not considered white. But how about the rest of us who don't look quote unquote white, even though we've been here even longer? That's the test, right? That's the test, because Black folks, people of color, will never be absorbed into whiteness ever. So will we dismantle this ideology of supremacy and have true equality, or will we double down and fight for it and burn the country down? That's the test for the next 20 years.
We're talking to Wajahat Ali about his new book, Go Back to Where You Came From, and other helpful recommendations on becoming American. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with writer and author Wajahat Ali about his new memoir, Go Back to Where You Came From, and other helpful recommendations on becoming American. Wajahat, you think a lot about the portrayal of Pakistani Americans, Muslim Americans in pop culture. I want to take you to a moment. You were younger. Your first kind of breakthrough as a writer was this play you wrote about a Pakistani American family. You're in talks to maybe bring it to LA, and an agent says, hey, maybe as the Pakistani American dad, what do you think of Ted Danson?
Yeah. And I laughed, and there was no other laughter on the other end. And I'm like, wait, you're serious? And he said, yeah, Americans like Ted Danson. I'm like, who doesn't like Ted Danson? I love Ted Danson. I love Cheers. I also like Becker. I also saw him in Gulliver's Travels, but this is a, a story about a Pakistani-American family, and the father, Salman, is a middle-aged Pakistani man. He goes, well, think about Ted Danson. And this was, you know, the play, The Domestic Crusaders, I started writing as a senior at UC Berkeley after 9/11 upon the suggestion and recommendation of my teacher, Ishmael Reed, who's a MacArthur Genius winner. And he, as a black man, said, listen, we've been fighting back for 400 years. Art and culture is how we fight back and tell our stories. Your people, I'm looking at the news right now after 9/11, your people are going to get hazed for 10 years. He was wrong. It's been 20 years. But he said, I've never seen an American story, a kitchen drama story, told from a perspective of, you know, like Muslims or Pakistanis. Write a story like that. And so that story, I had to do it myself, Rob, because I was told 20 years ago, the mainstream will never accept an ethnic story. Translation, white people will not accept a story of brown and Muslim folks. Take away all the ethnic stereotypes and take away all the ethnic mirch and the masala and make it easy and palatable. I proved them wrong. We did it ourselves. And I just want to flex for a moment. This play that was rejected and mocked and ridiculed 6 months ago, 20th anniversary of 9/11, it was republished by McSweeney's with a foreword by Hasan Minhaj and a new conversation between me and Ishmael Reed and Carla Blank. And the play is being taught in schools. The play has been performed around the world. The play is being sold. And so sometimes you just have to do it yourself, have faith in your story, and have faith that the mainstream will come along.
Let's bring on a caller now. Stephanie is with us in Milwaukee. Stephanie, hi.
Hi. I had a comment and also a question. I'm really interested in this topic. I'm a psychology graduate student, and I'm really interested in intersectionality and cultural humility and working with clients. And then just from my experience, I think that it's really helpful to talk about these things, but there are some kind of things that make it difficult for people to talk about it. So my question is, how are some like maybe general ways that can be really good to talk about these things with people, but also with children, because I work with a lot of children, to just talk about this like in a more open way so that we can talk about our different backgrounds, but also talk about difficult kind of topics and how we can talk in a more like inclusive way, including everyone in this conversations that are very important. Thank you.
Stephanie, thanks. A couple big questions there, Wajahat.
Yeah, look, I have three kids. My kids are age 7, 5, and 2. And my wife and I have this conversation all the time is because you simultaneously want to infuse in them the sense of pride in their culture and their skin color and their tone, especially which is under assault right now in America and their religion. But at the same time, you don't want them to be chauvinists also, right? Or restrictive or reactionary. And we live in a diverse community in Virginia. And so their classmates are different skin tones and different ethnicities and national origins. So what we say is, listen, this is who we are. You know, you're Pakistani American. This is your name. You're Muslim. But listen, at the same time, we live in a country where there's different people, there's different setups, there's different families. And as such, be respectful to everyone. And so what we do is we have had faith in them and their intelligence. So we talk to them. We talk to them at their level. We explain it to them. They're very curious. They understand. I'll give you an example. Even during the pandemic, we explained to them, this is why we're doing lockdown. This is why we're doing virtual school. There's a pandemic. This is COVID. This is why we wear masks. This is why we wash our hands. My children, ages 7, 5, and 2, Rob, wear masks, social distance, right? Clean their hands and understand the reason why they're doing it is to protect themselves and other folks. So even when it comes to topics about racism and culture and diversity and colorism, which we have to deal with if you're brown and black, because light skin tone is still the preferred skin tone. And my poor 5-year-old daughter, a couple of months ago, I wrote a New York Times article about this. She looked in the mirror and she said, oh, I wish I was light skin tone. That's beautiful. And I was like, no, everything we've done for 5 years, it's failure. And so we just doubled down and instead, you know, reaffirmed her beauty, her brownness, her brown skin tone, and said there's different colors there. But, you know, you are brown and you're beautiful, just like someone who's white or black is beautiful, but this is who you are. So when you're a brown and black person in this country, you are forced to have these uncomfortable conversations about racism, right, and colorism. And I'll just say that really quickly because oftentimes we're having this conversation, and, oh, my God, our children, they can't tolerate these conversations. We have to protect them. I'm like, I was confronted with this at the age of 5 when I was dropped off at preschool and someone said, your skin color is the color of poo. Kids are dealing with this stuff, and it's up to us as parents to actually engage them and give them the right language and the right type of empathy and kindness, and also have faith in them that, listen, you know, this is the world we live in, and these are some of the values that we have, and you can be proud of who you are, but you also have to live in a community of diversity and understand that other folks have different lifestyles as well. And so that's how we've tried to model it. We just go straight in. We talk to them. We treat them with intelligence and sensitivity. And they get it. The kids get it.
Thanks for that call, Stephanie. We're talking to Wajahat Ali. His new book is Go Back to Where You Came From and Other Helpful Recommendations on Becoming American. Wajahat, I hope you don't mind if I spoiled the ending a little bit. You come out with a full endorsement of the power of hope. And as a dad, the story you tell to back that up really hit me. Can you share the story of your daughter and how people came together to give you this hope?
Yeah, the last chapter of the book is called Invest in Hope, but Tie Your Camel First, which is based on this beautiful saying in Islam, this, yeah, have faith in God, but tie your camel first, which means do everything within your power to fix your situation. And after you've done that, you know, there's nothing else you can do except have faith. And, you know, having hope is very dangerous oftentimes in hopeless times, because it means exposing yourself to the possibility that when the page turns, it brings a better story. But oftentimes we're met with what? Pain, disappointment, betrayal, regret. And so it's easier to curl up and have your shields go up and be defensive and cynical and apathetic, right? But like I said in the book, that often requires zero investment and means being a spectator. You know, being in the ring of life means exposing yourself to pain. And that was really brought to the forefront with my daughter's diagnosis 3 years ago, where she was diagnosed 8 months before the pandemic with stage 4 liver cancer, all over the liver with a cancer speck in her lungs. And we're like, we didn't know she'd survive. And we needed a full liver transplant, and time was running out. And with the power of storytelling, I shared Nuseiba's story, and over 500 people, mostly strangers, stepped up to potentially be a liver donor for a girl they had never met, including people who told me they hated my politics, but they wanted to save a little girl. And finally, this one anonymous donor, who later revealed himself to be Sean Zaheer, who coincidentally lived close by, decided, oh, let me go give a piece of my liver to this little girl. And this little girl survived because a community came together to rally around a little girl who had stage 4 cancer. You know, we raised the funds, raised the word, got an anonymous donor, Sean Zaheer. And now Nuseiba is in the next room, dressed up in one of her many costume changes of the day, Rob. You know, cancer-free, healthy, living her best life. And, you know, she's still immunosuppressed during a pandemic, but, you know, throughout that journey, I imagined what would happen if she passed away, if she prepared myself as a parent, right? Mm-hmm. So I imagined it, and I steeled myself with these possibilities. But there was also another narrative where she lived, and she lived to be happy and healthy and married and have kids. And I chose to invest in that story.
Do I remember this right? Sean Zaheer, the person who had donated a chunk of liver to your daughter, his question on waking up is, Doc, when can I donate blood next time?
Yeah. Just that was his first question. And the doctor who operated on him, he started crying. He said, listen, I've done this a lot of times. That's the first time I've ever had a donor wake up and ask that question. Usually it's like, when can I get back to work? Am I safe? Am I healthy? But he said, hey, when can I give blood again? Because he's also a marrow and blood donor. And then he told me, he says, you have a good man's liver in your daughter. You have a good man's liver in your daughter. You're very lucky.
And just our last minute, Wajahat, how can we follow his example? I don't know. How can we pick that path of hope and generosity over all the other stuff we know is out there?
In the final minute, I will say this. I often get told, I'm nobody, Waj. And I'm like, some of my favorite people are nobody. I'm a nobody also. I think everyone has a superhero talent. Everyone has something. And the way you behave, the way you model yourself every day in your life, at home, at school, at work, can be a reflection of how you want this country to be. Run for school board. Run for city council. You know, go out to a church, do interfaith, give money to the right candidates. In your behavior, in your language, change it up to be more empathetic, more sensitive, and try to model this behavior for your children. Think about how that will impact future generations. At the end of the day, we can only control our own actions and our own intentions. And if we model that behavior, then you know what? That's the best way to go out.
Wajahat, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Rob, for having me.
Wajahat Ali is a columnist for the Daily Beast. He's a playwright. He was with us sharing his new book. It's called Go Back to Where You Came From and Other Helpful Recommendations on Becoming American. Coming up after the news, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. We'll take a look at Mexican cuisine with Patty Heenich, host of the PBS show Patty's Mexican Table. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.